astounding educational missionary history. It's important to Native Alaskans because it proves that the lie is a lie. It exposes it as a lie. But that's only chipping away over at this end of the cycle. To get at the root of the problem, we need to take these people and help them to become their own experts. It means every graduate we have of St. Herman's Seminary proves that the lie is a lie. Because we run our own churches. That's one institution the government didn't take over completely. And so it's our entree. Now we have Native Alaskan priests graduating from our school who read and write. Father Martin Nikolai knows Slavonic fairly well, but certainly knows English and Yupik fluently and does translations all the time. Composes liturgical music that's sung by the St. Vladimir's Choir in Crestwood, New York. His very existence says, we can. We are. It's not something only for, you see, it's going to take 100 years maybe. It's not going to happen overnight, and we're going to suffer losses in the meantime. That's inevitable. Once you're in the middle of a war, you don't just turn it off. It doesn't go away by wishful thinking. But we can move people from this position of dependence, where they're always second class and second in command, to leadership roles. This is what I believe Native Alaskans are saying when they talk about sovereignty. They are absolutely not talking about running white people out of the state. They are saying, give us back control of our lives, our families, and our communities, and allow us to run it, yes, the way you want in general, but loosen up the regulations a little bit and give us some elbow room, and let us do it in ways that make sense in our context, in our culture, in our community, according to our traditions. Give us some freedom. For 100 years, those immigrant kids stood before the pledge, before the flag of the United States and pledged allegiance to it. So do the native kids. And they believe in what that promise of liberty and justice for all represents. But you see, that's our crossroads today. Do we really believe in liberty and justice? Freedom for people to be different from us and not the same as us. We Orthodox certainly should be ready to applaud. Because what hope does our mission have in America if we can't ask people to be different from something they've already learned or something they've already been taught? We have to hope that they'll be open to a different point of view, another way of understanding, a deeper, richer, more ancient faith than the one to which they've been exposed or in which they've been brought up. And we're free in this country, as Professor Kessler said the other day, we're free in this country to do that, to be the church. And that's the greatest mission we have here. If the church can be the church and help provide people with a sense of leadership, the church is providing leadership, the seminary is providing leadership for Native Alaskans to assume leadership roles in their communities as artists, for those who have that talent, as singers, as theologians, as pastors, and actually as school teachers, as alcohol and drug counselors, because it's one of our main sub-courses, minor courses at the seminary. Not because, you see, then these experts are not somebody from somewhere else. They're our own people from within, and that helps prove we can. So in this respect, you see, this is the context in which we operate now. St. Innocent didn't have this. St. Yaakov didn't have this. Patriarch Tikhon faced it because it was falling into place. If you want a dependent population who had no rights, whose spiritual and sacred heritage was being trampled, try Russia. And so it's no surprise that these problems are rampant there too. But bringing in American experts who know how to set up the 1-800 number doesn't make the problem go away. This may help to some extent, but to really solve the problem takes a restructuring, a real perestroika. Now out of this, there's a lot of horror and a lot of pain. Unknown to us at the beginning of this century, and probably unknown to us until the last 10 or 15 years. And yet out of this desolation, as you will now hear, comes also great grace and mercy. I was once asked, my senior year in seminary by Professor Verhofskoy, John Dunlop's grandfather. John was with us a couple days ago just for a couple of these lectures. He once asked me, did I ever think that I had met a saint? And I thought for a moment and said, yeah, maybe, just maybe, possibly one. And he said, me too, but he didn't tell me who it was, and I didn't tell him more about mine either. But when I wrote Orthodox Alaska about 10 years ago, I wanted to show not only the great missionary history of the Alaskan Church, and not only the terrible situation in which we find ourselves today, but also some glimpse of what is still authentic and pure and good there, indigenous to and coming organically from the Orthodox cultural, spiritual experience in rural Alaska. So I wrote a couple of pages, two or three pages, about just one woman as a little vignette. Her name was Olga Michael. And I have reason to believe that in her youth, I don't know exactly under what circumstances, she suffered from a household that in which these behaviors, at least maybe for the first time, appeared. But that was behind her. She married the man who was the postman, actually, in her village. And until he was 55 or 60, her husband was the postmaster of the community. His English was quite good, you see, and that's what it took to be postmaster. People would bring you letters, even the Sears catalog, and have you and point to what you wanted, the size and color, and the postman had to fill it all out for them, because he was the one who could do the English well enough. It was the school teacher or the postmaster who assisted you in these ways. So he was, for his generation, a very well-educated man. They had 8 children, I think. And this woman was really tough. She was the village midwife and delivered at least 2 of her kids herself, since there was nobody else to help her. In later life, her husband, who was also active in the church, went to Sitka, spent about 6 months there under the personal mentorship of Archbishop Ambrosi, and came home a deacon. And the following summer, when the bishop came through for the annual conference, her husband was ordained priest, and she became Matushka, which meant that she now had to make all the vestments and bake all the prosfora, and eventually, of course, sewed all the matching altar coverings and lectern analoy covers for the church. So she spent years simply making the next color, and then not only for her husband, but for everything else. Altar boy robes, grandchildren came, they all had to all serve in the altar. She was constantly busy, mostly with sewing. And if she wasn't doing sewing for the church, she was doing knitting or sewing for others. I remember meeting her. She was like a Dorcas, you know, from the Acts of the Apostles. She was knitting mittens, gloves, and socks. She was never idle. She was simply never idle. And everyone in town, all her many grandchildren and children, had mittens or gloves and socks yearly. Her mittens, you know, they were homemade knitted thing. They lasted a year. They wore like iron. And so you wore them throughout the coming winter. I have mittens and socks that she made for me. The neighbors had. When we were building the new church in Fairbanks, she had no money. She made a set of what we call in the tourist trade mukluks, fur boots, kamaksik in Yupik. She said, I have no money, but maybe you can auction or raffle or sell these to make money for your building fund. So she used her sewing talents constantly, not only to support her husband and his ministry, and not only to beautify the church in her village, but also as gifts to friends and relatives and neighbors. And finally, even to raise funds for other churches. She'd never been to Fairbanks in her life. She'd only heard they were trying to build a new Orthodox church in Fairbanks, and so you have to do something to help them out. Well, about 15 years ago, she was getting sick, and no one knew exactly what she had. It was finally diagnosed as cancer, and for a while she was bedridden. Her daughters decided about this time of the year, however, while their mother was declining, to go to Kodiak Island and pray at the reliquary of St. Herman of Alaska. And Bishop Gregory, knowing the family, of course, offered a molyeben, a prayer service at the grave of St. Herman. After the pilgrimage, they returned home, and much to their shock, when they entered the house, their mother's bed was empty. They waited for a while. They searched everywhere, looking what happened to Mom. And within a few minutes, in she came, carrying 5-gallon buckets of water from the village well. Since their molyeben in Kodiak, she had gotten out of bed, was up and around and doing the household chores, which lasted a full year. For a full year, she was completely in good health. But she knew that although she had been granted this reprieve, she would soon die. And she began to instruct people about what she wanted done. She said, "Don't grieve for me. I've had a good life, and I go to the Lord. Bury me in my wedding gown," which for most women wouldn't fit, but for her, it did. And her death was exactly what we pray for at almost any service, a Christian ending to our life, blameless, painless, and peaceful. She sat up in bed. She looked to the icons and crossed herself. She crossed her arms as if to receive Holy Communion and laid down and fell asleep. This was in November, however, and all her grandchildren were at Edgecombe High School, so a telephone call there, "Please get the kids back." But by the time they arrived, she was gone. November is already pretty cold on the Kuskokwim. The rivers are frozen and there's snow. But the night she died, it got warm. The snow melted. And in fact, the ice went out on the river as if it were springtime, as if it's what we call breakup here in Alaska. People came to her funeral by boat. No one can remember this ever happening. And then, after the funeral, with many priests, because the whole deanery, of course, came, as they brought her coffin out of the church, this sounds like something out of a medieval life of some saint, doesn't it? A flock of birds appeared. We all know the smart birds leave Alaska in August, right? We don't have flocks of birds in November. But this flock of birds continued to circle the church as the choir and the pallbearers carried her coffin around St. Nicholas Church and to her burial site. They buried her, as I mentioned, in the traditional Eskimo way, not concluding the funeral with memory eternal, but with having beheld the resurrection. And then the wind began to blow, and people scurried to their boats and went back to their villages, and that night the earth froze and winter returned. It was as if the cosmos itself participated in this burial, and the earth itself opened to receive her. Now, that much I told in my book. 3 years ago, I received a very unusual letter. A woman from out of state said, "I've been going to therapy. I've had some really horrible childhood experiences. It was really, I hope you'll excuse my mentioning it, but it was sexual abuse of a young girl." And she said, "I was going to therapists. In fact, the therapists were Orthodox and actually had lived in Alaska for a while. And in the midst of these several years of seeing these counselors and working on my pain, I had this vision while at prayer." The woman, by the way, was not Orthodox at the time. She said, I saw this older woman with a very kind face who spoke to me not with words, but only with her eyes. And she led me down a path. Now, the landscape, she said, was very different from any place I'd ever been. It was absolutely, completely flat and treeless, and the ground was spongy. That's the Kuskokwim Delta, if I ever heard of it, but that's what I'm thinking already as I'm reading this letter, right? And she said, "And this lady took me to the side of a hill, but it wasn't a hill. We went around the other side and there was a low doorway in it, and we went inside the hill." You already know what that is. "There was a stone bowl there filled with some kind of oil and a small flame. So that was the only light inside, and the only window was in the roof. The woman had me lie down, and she massaged me as if I were giving birth to a child. The woman treated me as if she were a midwife and I giving birth, but I wasn't pregnant. And I felt like all the pain and all the darkness and all the humiliation and grief in me came out. This woman said nothing to me. She led me outside, we sat down, and she served me some herbal tea. And then I asked her her name, and the woman said, something Olga. But I didn't understand what this was. That was the letter I got. And she went to her counselors, and the counselor said, she went to her counselors and said, is there a Saint Olga? And they said, yes, of course. And they went to St. Vladimir's bookstore and got an icon of St. Olga for her. And she looked at it and said, it's not her. So the woman said, well, is there another St. Olga? Now, fortunately, these former Alaskans of ours had also read Orthodox Alaska. They remembered two or three pages and so forth. And they said, well, Father Alexa wrote about a Matushka Olga. She said, that's it. It's Matushka Olga. So then I got this letter. Do you have a picture of Matushka Olga? I was leaving for Russia the next day for a whole year. I couldn't respond to her. And I have her. I have two pictures of Matushka Olga, but I have also volumes of photographs. There was no way I could go through every album, especially since we were leaving and the rest. So I went off to Russia with this on my mind. I came back in March and had to go to Kuitluk for a conference to talk actually to the high school students about this. And the relatives of Matushka Olga said, they had this long letter. Did you read this? Do you know about this? And I said, who's it from? And they told me the woman's name. I said, I've heard of her. She sent me a letter like a year ago, only I never got back to her. They said, well, she wants a picture of Mom. I said, send her a picture, but send her a picture, if you have one, with several women in it, and see if in this group she can identify. I'll tell you the rest after our break. We better take the picture before it gets too dark. Two hours. Ugh. After not receiving any response from me because I was over in Moscow, this same informant, knowing that Kuitluk was a very small village, decided just to try to contact some family members there. So she asked her friends back in New York, do you know any relatives of Matushka Olga? And they said yes, and they gave her a name. So she wrote this, pretty much the same story as I just told you, in a letter, again requesting a photograph. And that's where we left off. I advised them, yes, find a photograph, but find one with several women in it. It will help us to positively identify Matushka Olga as the one she saw in this dream or vision. Well, the letter got passed around to other family members. The younger daughter who received it was so amazed. She passed it to her older brother, the oldest in the family. He took it home and read it. Couldn't believe what he was reading. So he read it again. He still couldn't quite believe it. He read it a third time. And after reading it for the third time, he told me he began to smell incense as if he were in church. At this point, his wife came home. He said, read this. So she read it. She couldn't believe it either. She read it again, and the third time. And when she read it the third time, she also began to smell the sweet fragrance of incense. Neither husband nor wife mentioned it to the other. At this point, a third person, I don't know who, entered the house and said to them, what's that incense you're burning? So they sent a photo. And the woman who wrote this testimony I've been quoting to you recognized her immediately but said, when I saw her, she was younger. Well, it's understandable. The whole scene in her vision is from the turn of the century when people were still living in the traditional houses. There are none left. There's no such place that you could walk today to go into a traditional home and find the smoke hole, the window in the roof, and so forth. But it would have been possible when Matushka Olga was much younger. Now, I'll read to you, because after all of this, I wrote back to the woman. I came back from Russia, obviously. I wrote to her and I said, give me all the whole story. Who are you? Why were you? And so I'll read to you. This woman absolutely insists on being anonymous. She doesn't want to give the slightest hint that she is doing any of this somehow for her own glory or credit. She absolutely insists no one know who she is. So I'm married 25 years and have two children. I am a sculptor and an architectural designer. I was raised in a non-Orthodox church and was searching for a deeper life of faith for quite a while. My friend Lynn Breck, wife of Father John Breck, now retired from St. Vladimir's Seminary in Crestwood, New York, introduced me to Orthodoxy in 1995. I had attended a few services and read Father Oleksa's book, Orthodox Alaska. His account of Matushka Olga's death was all that I knew about her. I didn't know at that time she had been a midwife. I don't mention it in my book. And she only read the book, by the way, after this whole experience. It wasn't like she, one of the few books she read about Orthodoxy was Orthodox Alaska. She picked it up because when she said, isn't there another Saint Olga, the Brecks told her, well, there is this story. In November of 1995, Matushka Olga Michael of Kuitluk, Alaska, miraculously healed me with her wisdom as a midwife, her own experience of her sufferings, transformation through grace, God's clear truth, and her sacred understanding of God's plan of salvation. My conversion to the Orthodox faith was a natural result of God's blessing and tenderness toward me through the love of Matushka Olga, 20 years after her death. At the time, the fall of 1995, I had been working for about 4 years to understand my own life and childhood. The remembering process had been very painful. I had to accept that my mother's family made much of its money by catering to the unnatural wishes of some very wealthy people who had no respect for children. We all know that child pornography exists and that much of it is made when children are used as if they were grown women. We know too that children are dependent on adults and can be used by them literally as slaves and have no control over their own surroundings. We just don't expect to meet anyone who grew up like that, much less to admit that such things are true in one's own life. My experience had shown me that the good things of God were not for me. I felt I deserved what I got. I felt I wasn't entitled to the air that I breathed or the space that I took up in a room, so deep was my guilt and shame. From where I sat, the world did not belong to God. It was polluted and controlled by lust and by cruelty. Though I could see the beauty of creation, it wasn't meant for me. Matushka Breck can confirm the truth of my state of being before Matushka Olga came to me in prayer. One day I was deeply at prayer and awake. I remembered an event that was very frightening. My prayer began with asking the Holy Theotokos to help, for help and mercy. Gradually, I was aware of standing in a forest, feeling still a little frightened. Soon a gentle wave of tenderness began to sweep through the forest, followed by a fresh garden scent. I saw the Virgin Mary dressed as she is on an icon, but more natural looking and brighter, walking toward me. As she came closer, I was aware of someone walking behind her. She stepped aside and gestured to a short, wise-looking woman. I asked her, "Who are you?" The Virgin Mary answered, "Saint Olga." Matushka Olga gestured for me to follow her. We walked a long way until there weren't any trees. We came to a little hill that had a door cut into the side. She gestured for me to sit and she went inside. After a while, some smoke came out of the top of the hill. You understand. Matushka came out with herbal tea. We both sat in silence, drinking our tea and feeling the warmth of the sun on our faces. I began to get a pain in my belly, and she led me inside. The door was so low I had to duck, like bowing in prayer, but it's simply a traditional entrance way. Inside the hill was dry and warm and very quiet. The light was very soft, coming from a shallow bowl and from the open hole on the top of the hill, a stone lamp and the smoke hole. Everything around me felt gentle, especially Mother Olga. The little hill house smelled like wild thyme and white pine in the sun with roses and violets mixed in. Matushka Olga helped me up to a kind of platform bed, like a driftwood box filled with moss and grasses. It was soft and smelled like the earth and the sea. I was exhausted and lay down. Matushka went over to the lamp and warmed up something which she rubbed on my belly. I looked 5 months pregnant. I was not really pregnant at the time. I started to labor. I was a little scared. Mother Olga climbed up beside me and gently holding my arm, she pretended to labor with me, showing what to do and how to breathe. She still had said nothing. She helped me push out some stuff like afterbirth, which kind of soaked into the moss on the box bed. I was very tired and crying a little from relief when it was over. Up until this, she hadn't spoken, but her eyes spoke with great tenderness and understanding. We both got up and had some tea. As we were drinking it, Matushka Olga gradually became the light in the room. Her face looked like it was a strong light bulb or the sun shining under her skin, but I think the whole of her glowed. I was just so connected to her loving gaze, I didn't pay much attention to anything else. It was the kind of loving gaze from a mother to an infant that connects and welcomes a baby to life. She seemed to pour tenderness into me through her eyes. This wasn't frightening, even though at the time I didn't know about people who literally shone with the love of God. It made more sense after I read about Saint Seraphim. I know now that some very deep wounds were being healed at that moment. She gave me back my own life, which had been stolen, a life that is now defined by the beauty and love of God for me, the restored work of his hands. After some time, I felt like I was filled with wellness, and a sense of quiet entered my soul, as if my soul had been crying like a grief-stricken, abandoned infant, and now had finally been comforted. Even now as I write to you, the miracle of the peacefulness, and also the zest of life wellness has brought, causes me to cry with joy and awe. Only after this did Matushka Olga speak. She spoke about God and people who choose to do evil things. She said the people who hurt me thought they could make me carry their evil inside me by rape. She was very firm when she said, "That's a lie. Only God can carry evil away. The only thing they could put inside you was the seed of life, which is a creation of God and cannot pollute anyone." I was never polluted. It just felt that way because of the evil intentions of the people near me. What I had held inside me was the pain, terror, shame, and helplessness. We had labored together, and that was all out of me now. She burned some grass over a little flame, and the smoke went straight up to God, who is both the judge and the forgiver. I understood by the incense that it wasn't my job to carry the sins of people against me either. It was God's, and that was an ever-unfolding rich, and what an ever-unfolding richness this taste of salvation is. At the end of this healing time, we went outside together. It was dark now, in my prayer or vision. There were so many stars stretching to infinity. The sky was all a shimmer with a moving veil of light. I had seen photos of the aurora, the northern lights, but I didn't know that they move. Either Matushka Olga said, or we both heard in our hearts, I really can't remember which, that the moving curtain of light was to be for us a promise that God can create great beauty from complete desolation and nothingness. For me, it was like proof of the healing, great beauty where there had been nothing before but despair and shame. One fruit of this healing has been my steady commitment to prayer for those who do evil, as well as for those who are harmed by it. The depth of the riches of God for forgiveness is infinite and yearns to be poured out as a balm for both perpetrator and victim alike. Into the place of sorrow and degradation in my soul, Holy Mother Olga had poured out herself, her own sacred gentleness, to heal me. I now know that sins against children are sins against God, their Creator. The Blessed Trinity and the Holy Theotokos brought me, she calls her here, Saint Olga, because they knew she would know best how to heal me so that I would understand. I'm very grateful to Holy Mother Olga for being so good to me. I always remember her in prayer, and the beauty of her gifts to me continue to deepen and grow, as does my life in faith. I pray that you will find Holy Mother Olga worthy of veneration as a saint of the Church. She seems to me to be a saint, especially for children, for women and children who have been abused.